pretty dress-up clothes to wear, bright bows, cute hair, are just a part of her story. Heart so big and eyes so bright, a love that reflects God's glory. She danced and sang and laughed and lived a life full of joy.
I'm Ruth Fisher on Jazz FM, and I'm delighted to talk to saxophonist Jimmy Green, who has just released a brand new album on the Mac Avenue label.
Thanks for having me on, Ruth.
My pleasure. As I said, you've just released a brand new album on the Mac Avenue label called Beautiful Life, which was inspired by your daughter Anna, who was tragically killed 2 years ago in the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. What was the key reason of making this album?
Well, in the aftermath of my daughter's murder, a lot was reported and discussed about the way that she died. And I really wanted to give people a glimpse of the way that she lived. And for me as a musician and a performer and a composer, that the way that I really felt would best exemplify the way she lived would be through music. Music is something that runs deep in my family, in my wife's family, and in our children, and something that Anna loved. She was a wonderful singer, and she loved to dance as a six-year-old, and I really felt a musical portrayal of her short but beautiful life would be appropriate.
How long did it take for you to be able to get back into the studio, or even just to pick up the saxophone after this awful incident?
Several weeks. After you experience a trauma and a shock the way that we did here, it takes the body a while to recover in some small way from that. Emotionally and psychologically, I'm still very much in a recovery phase, but physically, I wasn't able to do simple things in the days and weeks after my daughter's murder. And it took a while to get back to be able to doing the things that I would normally do.
And interestingly enough, your faith has been a very significant part of your life. And indeed, the album features modern Christian music, hymns, and even some spirituals. How did you draw on your faith during this whole process of putting this album together?
Well, our faith teaches us that our life on earth is not the end of our story. At the end of our life on earth is not the end of our story, that we, through our faith, can hope for a reunion with our Heavenly Father and with all those who also are in heaven too. So, you know, I firmly believe my daughter's there, and pretty much the only source of comfort that I've had, and I can speak for my family as well, that we've had in the last 2 years now, is that we look forward to that reunion one day.
Right. Did you ever question your faith? Did you ever turn around and say, why me? Why my daughter?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a very normal, very human reaction. And sometimes I still question. And I'm accepting that I probably won't get answers here on earth, because the way in which she was killed is so senseless, and there's no reason for it. There's no explaining the why of it. And those things, as much as I've racked my brain and struggled and asked God, why my daughter, why Anna? You know, what did she ever do to deserve something like this? I know that I won't get those answers here on earth.
The album was based originally on a book that she did for you. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, the album is sort of the culmination of a lot of thought and meditation and just thinking of musical ways in which I could accurately portray portions of who my daughter was and hopefully give a glimpse as to who I am a bit as well. Anna was a really loving and generous child, generous with her affections, generous with her encouragement to people. And she always did little things to show those around her that she loved them and was always thinking about them. And one thing that she did for me was she drew me a book. And I actually never had seen this book when she was alive. I found the book in her playroom. My kids share a room in our home with all their toys and crafts and things. And I found in her playroom when I got home after learning that she wouldn't be coming home, that she had been killed. I got home and found Anna's flower book for Dad, she titled it, on the desk in the playroom later that afternoon. And it's a beautiful book with page after page of these really sweet, hand-drawn, colored flowers, page after page of flowers. And it wasn't for any special occasion. She had just done it just to say, I love you, Dad. And she did that, you know, pretty regularly. That wasn't an odd occurrence. She did that all the time for her brother, for me, for her mom, for her friends, for other family members. She was just that kind of girl. Even now, 2 years later, I'm so glad that I had the chance to get to know her, to be around her, to be her dad for 6.5 years.
Aside from your faith, it also seems that there are many in the jazz world who pulled together for you after this event. The album itself features a whole host of who's who in the jazz world, such as Kurt Elling, Kenny Barron, Christine McBride, Pat Metheny. How did that all come about?
All of the people you mentioned are amazing musicians, some of the best examples of jazz artists that we have living today. And apart from that, they're amazing human beings with warm, huge, open hearts that when they heard that this had happened to my daughter, they came rushing and said, in whatever way we can help, please use us. Please, we'll be there for you. And, you know, there's so many other musicians that don't appear on the recording that sent me songs that they had written for Anna or held fundraisers in her honor and donated the money to my family and me or to charities that we had set up in Anna's name. I mean, the community of musicians has been amazing in supporting us through this whole ordeal. This entire project really got its genesis from a conversation I had with my dad, who had told me, you know, Jimmy, the grief that you feel now will be with you for a long time. But don't ever forget in the midst of your grief that you have a lot of beauty that's surrounding you right now and that will continue to surround you. So as much as you're dealing with your grief now, and you will be for quite some time, don't let your grief blind you to the beautiful things you have now. And for me, that was very powerful. And it kind of got me back to some sort of routine as far as playing music again. And not long thereafter, I had a conversation with Norman Chesky, who, along with his brother David Chesky, they run Chesky Records. David is a great composer and musician in his own right. And the two brothers started Chesky Records. And they run a website. They founded a business called HD Tracks, which is kind of the audiophile's answer to iTunes. It's a digital download site where you can download an ever-expanding catalog of music, but in high-definition audio, high-resolution files. Norman Chesky contacted me and offered to donate the production of a record whenever I felt like I was able to, with no time frame limitation or no hurry to get it done. But he really felt like he wanted to reach out and offer this to me because when he heard about the tragedy and heard that a jazz musician's daughter had been killed, he looked on his HD Tracks site and he realized that one of my previous recordings, Mission Statement, was for sale on his site. And he felt like through that connection, he really wanted to work to reach out and to try to help in some way. So Norman offered this amazing gift with no strings attached, and he offered not just to donate the production of a recording, but to assign 100% control of the masters and 100% ownership of the masters to me, which is an amazing gift. So that really got me focused on this project, trying to write and arrange some music that in some way would reflect the kind of human being my daughter was. I made some calls to some of my favorite people and musicians, and they all said, of course, we'll be there. A portion of the proceeds benefit two charities that we've set up in my daughter's name. One through my wife and an agency that she has dealt with in the past. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist. And through partnership with Klingberg Family Centers, they set up the Honor Grace Project. And their slogan is creating love, community, and connection for every child and family. And they've done some amazing work in our community here in Connecticut. And also the Artist Collective, which is where I first met Jackie McLean and really started my love and really my career as a jazz musician, being exposed to him and the music at the Artist Collective, which is an arts, multi-discipline arts training facility in one of Connecticut's most economically disadvantaged neighborhoods. And the collective has done an amazing job of providing access to the arts for children and families for generations. So those two charities are receiving funds from the sale of this recording, and we set it up that way.
You mentioned Jackie McLean because, interestingly enough, on the album there is a track called "Where Is Love," which mm-hmm. has an interesting story behind it to do with Jackie. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. When I was a 15-year-old in high school, a wonderful teacher named Yvonne Redondi from my high school organized a meeting with me and Mr. McLean at the Artist Collective. And that very first day, he showed me the melody to "Where Is Love." And in the months and days and weeks and months after Anna was killed, I had a lot of time to reflect. And that song was on my mind as something that was very reminiscent of a kind of a turning point in my life. And, you know, Jackie is a very huge figure for me and for many people. And I wanted to play the melody of that song just as he showed it to me on the recording.
Going back to your career, because you've had a very long and successful career, what made you choose the saxophone?
When I was a little boy, my dad, who is not a professional musician, he was always involved in trying to learn more about music and write music of his own. And when I was a little boy, he never played it professionally, but he had a saxophone in the house that he had played when he was a little boy himself. And he would take the saxophone out every once in a while, and he'd play whatever song he would remember from his childhood. But the one I remember him playing is, ironically, is a song of Horace Silver's, who I ended up playing with when I was a very young musician just starting out in New York. He played Horace Silver's Sister Sadie on the tenor saxophone that he had, and I just fell in love with the way the instrument looked and the way it sounded, and I bugged him until he got me my own. So that's how I started playing saxophone.
And did you always listen to jazz, or was that something that you acquired as you were older? Did you grow up listening? What sort of music did you grow up listening to?
Oh, when I was a really young kid, I listened to popular music. My favorites were Michael Jackson and Stevie Wonder and whatever the pop hits were in the early 80s, early to mid 80s. I was into rap music. In the mid 80s and stuff. So, yeah, Public Enemy and things like this, Run DMC. But my dad, in his studies, learning how to write and arrange music, he took a correspondence course from the Berklee College of Music in Boston. And he still had the books laying around when I was little and first started getting into the instrument. And when I was, oh, maybe 12 or so, I started playing in my my junior high school's jazz ensemble and started playing the music a bit, but never really listening to it. And my dad had a few jazz recordings. He was never a big jazz fan himself, but he had some recordings that in the course of his studying songwriting and arranging that he had come upon. One of them was a Coleman Hawkins recording called The Hawk Flies High. One of them was a Cannonball Adderley recording called Domination that featured arrangements by Oliver Nelson. And one was called Jerry Mulligan, the Arranger. And I started listening to those records and really just fell in love with the sound of them. And my dad, having grown up in Alabama in the 1950s and 60s in the black community, although he wasn't a jazz fan, the way that music worked in the community in those days is that, you know, the radio stations didn't just play one type of music as many of them do today. They played all types of music. So you can listen to the same radio station and hear jazz, hear blues, hear R&B, you know, all types of things. So he knew, even though he wasn't a huge jazz fan, he knew all the great jazz saxophone players. So he knew about Sonny Rollins and John Coltrane and Charlie Parker and Dexter Gordon. And Lester Young. So he got me an album of each of theirs. So as a 13 or 14 year old, I had a bunch of recordings, kind of one recording of each of those great saxophone players. And he also got me a Branford Marsalis recording, because at the time in the late 1980s, he was kind of like the new young lion. So yeah, from those recordings, just listening to those, I just fell in love with the music and just started buying recording after recording and kind of just devouring them.
How would you say that your dad's life was affected by the civil rights movement?
Well, he was right in the middle of it. I mean, he grew up, he was a young man. He graduated from high school in 1964 and from college in 1968 from his undergraduate. And he went all through undergraduate in his hometown of Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And the civil rights movement was very much a part of his everyday existence. It was a monumental time in our country, and I, you know, the people that were instrumental in assuring civil rights for all in the United States, I can't imagine the sacrifice and the struggle that they went through just to achieve, you know, some base level of human rights here in the United States. So I'm very appreciative of those of his generation, of him and those of his generation in the South during those years, during those really hard, ugly years in American history. There's a long way to go, as you can see from the events recently in Ferguson and other places. There's a long way to go, but there's been a lot of progress too.
And another aspect of the society that we see coming out of America is this issue of gun control. How do you think that America could deal with this issue? It's something that here in the UK we really haven't got our heads around at all. And you've been so affected by it.
There's a lot of things that can be done. What typically has happened is that there is a pretty sharp divide along party lines as to what to do with the issue of gun violence. And I really feel that the only way that we're going to, as a country, make any move toward being better and keeping our citizens and our children safer from gun violence is if we all come together. This issue, in my humble opinion, supersedes party affiliation. It's a human issue. It's a public health issue. It's not a political issue. With that being said, the things that I think are most effective and the things that my family and I have supported are measures that are common sense. Studies have shown that 90% of Americans actually support. These are things like requiring background checks for all gun sales, limiting magazine capacity, and for really advocating for those who do own guns to keep them locked and away and not accessible to people in their homes. I think these measures would save a lot of lives.
You yourself are known as a great educator, and you're currently the assistant professor of music and assistant coordinator of jazz studies at Western Connecticut State University. What is it you love about teaching?
I love the relationship. I love the interaction. I love the being able to participate in a young person finding their voice and really chasing after their passion, to see the great art form that so many before me sacrificed and struggled to just keep going, to maintain, to grow, to try in some small way to keep it going forward and to inspire young people to learn this language, I feel is so effective in conveying emotion and communicating with others in a way that words simply can't.
Jimmy, thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk to us here at Jazz FM.
Thank you for having me, Ruth. I appreciate it. Thank you.